in the 70s, McLuhan goes back to writing about Wyndham Lewis, because the 70s are not so excitable or synesthetic. They're kind of bland out. The boomers have exhausted themselves, and their younger brothers and sisters are going to school and not protesting. They're just taking business mid-courses. So you bring back sober Lewis. So that's how McLuhan would use, it's like Lewis would use Hitler at the beginning of the 30s. That's interesting, he said. Look at this phenomenon. But by the end of the 30s, even before World War II started, he's saying, no, Hitler don't work anymore. We got to look for some other interesting phenomenon. So the changing of yourself and your approach in your art, criticism, novels, essays, paintings, is depending on the society, which is called the formal causality, what the audience is at. So a guy like Lewis or McLuhan looks like they contradicted themselves. But no, they're changing with the time, so to speak, with the media, and they're doing it very precisely. They know, well, this is what's happening now, this is the medium, I'm going to be pro it for a while or anti it, depending on my strategy. And that's the roots of quadrophenia, which we all live now. You, Kate, go into environments, suss out what's going on, and figure out your mask or personality response to that. Or not. Or if you're lazy, you just be your ridiculous self in front of anybody, ignoring them. Because you don't have to worry about what the crowd thinks of you because you're never going to see them again. The decentralized society in the chemical body. So quadrophenia was worked out by Wyndham Lewis and McLuhan, and they're ahead of everybody. And when I spoke at the Wyndham Lewis conference in July 2014 in England, I spelled this out. I said Wyndham Lewis, with that statement from 1929, is the Dr. Spock of the 21st century. His statement is the most relevant statement for our time from anybody that was produced in the 20th century. So that the Wyndham Lewis guys loved hearing that. They're all for Lewis, but they didn't know what the fuck I was talking about. But the top guy, the main guy who gets all the academic gigs, Paul Edwards, there's two of them, Paul Edwards and Alan Munton, that started off the Wyndham Lewis scholarship in the early 70s, and that was dangerous because Lewis was not respected then in academia. And so they started it, and they became the two leading guys. And Paul Edwards got the Yale contract to make a big book on Lewis in 2000. So he comes up to me after the lecture. He says, I'm sorry, Bob, I missed your lecture. I had to go to another one because he has to be where the dignitaries are. He says, but I heard good things about it. So that's the only review I got, that the top guy had heard good things about my lecture. And I was just on Alan Munton, the other guy, started off the Lewis stuff. They got the first PhDs in Lewis in the 70s. I was telling him about some new stuff about Lewis and McLuhan and Herolytus, and he really appreciated this, what I told him. But he attended the lecture. Alan is more the populist guy. He'll hang out with the people, whereas Paul's a busy guy. He's got all the contracts, you know, for the big books. So Alan is someone I can talk to anytime I want. And so he gets to get the latest news on Lewis from me. That puts him ahead of Paul, at least for a little minute or two.
He has a cigarette in every picture.
Yep. Lewis did everything wrong. He had committed adultery. He's a ridiculous person. Borrowed from money, never paid them back. You read his biography.
The smoking,
what?
Everybody smokes. I mean, the smoking's not bothering me. It's just funny that it's like he's doing different things with them, like posing with his cigarette. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of posing. This great book I recommend to everybody called Some Sort of Genius. They don't even know what kind of genius Lewis is. He's so
interesting. I saw that.
That book, you've got to read it. If you want to read about a person, it's like The Last Human. He's up against the impersonal android meme that begins, you know, back in his day, the growing of it. And his strategies are pretty interesting. Yeah, Carol wants to say something.
Yeah, Bob, remember the anecdote where some woman...
Yeah, I was just going to bring it up, but you can go ahead.
Some woman reported that in the art school where Lewis attended, she was in a back room and she...
Not the art school, Carol.
Well, you better tell it.
Yeah, I better tell. In the 20s, you know, he's an artist who's starting to get attention. He's the enemy. He retreats when James Joyce's Ulysses comes out in 1922. His old friend James Joyce gets a lot of popularity from that, and Lewis is a bit suspicious of the people liking Joyce, so he retreats and writes this 1,500-page thing called The Man of the World, or The Man Who Knew Too Much. It wasn't The Man Who Knew Too Much, but Who Knew Too Much, but something like that, A Man of the World. And he chops up this huge opus in his poor ghetto attic where he's starving. He writes this huge thing, and he chops it up in the later 20s into many books. It's too big to release as one book. But so he's creating an image for himself as the enemy. And he had something to do with a theater where he walked into the backstage of a theater, and some actress was sleeping there, and Lewis didn't see her, and she woke up and watched him primp himself in front of the mirror with a new hat, trying to figure out the best angle to wear the hat, like a woman would do in a store. A woman in a store would be there. It's a very unmasculine thing he was doing, very concerned about how the hat was positioned as he presented himself for the public in the art galleries and the scene he was in London. And so this woman told another artist that she saw Lewis doing this. And that artist told the woman, never say that to anybody that you saw Lewis. Because if it gets out, Lewis will, as he said, any man will kill you. That's so embarrassing for a man back then, a macho guy, to be seen primping like a woman in front of a mirror. You know
oh,
what I mean?
Yeah.
But Lewis was both hemispheres. He was man, woman, and everything. So he was very conscious of his image and what he presented to the art crowd in London in the early 20s. So I was just going to tell that story, then Carol thought of it. Now I had to tell it. Yes.
Let me read you this review of the book, because it's kind of funny.
Which book?
This of Some Sort of Genius.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay, so, and this is just random. This is this man called Bruce Oskell who wrote this review of the book on January 23rd, 2008. He gave the book five stars.
I've been looking for reviews. I don't recognize that one. Send me that link after you read it when you
sure.
get a chance.
Sure. It says, and this is just on Amazon. He gave it five stars because the review is making me laugh. A Squandered Life, he titles his review. Title of book, Some Sort of Genius, A Life of Wyndham Lewis. Wyndham Lewis, quotes, people are only friends in so much as that they are of use to you. And that about says all you need to know about Wyndham Lewis, a self-promoter.
That's what Lewis said. Lewis said that. People,
right.
Friends are only good for you to use. Yes.
Right. And that about says all you need to know about Wyndham Lewis, a self-promoter who included himself as one of the four men of 1914, the other three, Eliot, Joyce, and Pound. Be that as it may, Lewis was a very strange, egocentric, self-destructive, modernist writer and a portrait artist, and inexplicably a ladies' man. This is what made me laugh.
Yeah.
I can't even read it. Why anyone would devote so much time and effort to write about such a loser is equally inexplicable.
I got something to say about that too. But yeah, okay, so they're talking about Paul O'Keefe, the writer of the book. So read that sentence again.
Right. Okay. Oh my goodness. Why anyone would devote so much time and effort to write about such a loser is equally inexplicable. But what makes Paul O'Keefe's biography so rewarding is all the name-dropping.
Yeah.
Lewis moved in with the Bloomsbury Group in London. He visited Gertrude Stein, Ernest Hemingway, and the other American expatriates in Paris between the two world wars, and through his affair with Marjorie Firminger, came close to entering the world of Henry Miller, Anais Nin, and D.H. Lawrence. His love affair with Nancy Cunard, the Paris Hilton of her day, and her girlfriends Iris Tree and Sybil Hart Davis add spice to the book. O'Keefe's exhaustive work becomes a bit tedious about halfway through, but that probably has to do more with Lewis than with O'Keefe. Once one realizes that Lewis is not going to change, that he has squandered talent and potential for lifelong friendships, and that there are good reasons why he is not in the same class as the other men of 1914, one starts to lose interest in his story. With a book that covers so much territory, literary, artistically, and geographically, it was critical that the author include a comprehensive index. And here again, O'Keefe does not fail. Two more things. First, the vignettes of Lewis's grandfather and father serving together in the U.S. Civil War and Lewis's own time on the front lines of World War I were outstanding. Second, this book is a great lead-up to a new book, Neil Parsons, Obelisk Press, A History of Jack Cahan. And Obelisk Press, I don't know what that is. But anyway, that's so funny. Isn't that funny?
And that is your average reaction. I would get you to read it. Halfway through, you'll be sick of it. You'll be sick of Lewis sabotaging every fucking thing he did. He'd sabotage it constantly. Books would get fucked up. He'd never get them out. They'd dig it out years later. Total destruction. But when you know what he did and who he had an influence on and how, you know, Paul Edwards and Alan Munton and the Lewis gang over there, mainly in England, because they see Lewis as a British artist, even though he was born in Nova Scotia near Dobbstown. It is more a Canadian, but he has a good dual citizenship, Canadian, American, and American father and British. So these British guys want to make Wyndham Lewis the hero of the 21st century, the way James Joyce was a culture industry in the 20th century. Now, it's probably not going to happen due to me and Iandom, but I support the cause. Lewis is incredible once you get past these bourgeois worries about what he's doing. He's very ionic. He's like, doesn't give a fuck about humanity. He's like what Ion says ascended people are. He's very curious, involved with everything, but he doesn't give a fuck about it, and he's not emotionally detached to anybody. The Nancy Kennard, his mistress, who goes, I think it's the one who ends up at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, starting. She's the woman who starts the film department at MoMA. I mean, he interacted with everybody that was prominent and smart and everything. So Nancy Kennard, heiress of the Kennard line, so major Paris Hilton hotels, right? So Paris Hilton of her day. Lewis fails to visit Iris Barry, I think her name is, when she's giving birth to his child. He's too busy traveling around with other people. And when she returns home to their place with their new baby, Lewis is too busy fucking Nancy Kennard to answer the door. None of you modern women would put up with this guy. Well, some of you in porn would, but most of you normal, educated women were not going to tolerate Wyndham Lewis. As a matter of fact, if we're successful at all to bring academic or some kind of attention to Lewis, it will be it'll be a Harvey Weinstein reaction. They'll say, no fucking way we're going to teach kids about this guy. He's the worst patriarchal fucking male chauvinist ever in history. But see, the thing is, he knew feminists. He supported feminism. He was unique in all his views. It really is mind-challenging what he does. But when Ayn comes along, the voice of God, and tells everybody to be a fucking asshole and it doesn't matter, then Lewis doesn't look so bad. Thanks to Ayn.
Right, right. What was her name? Nancy Kennard?
I think that's her name. It's not... Yeah, it's not Marjorie. Nancy Kennard. This is the 1920s.
Oh, I got to see this chick.
Yeah, look her up. Well, she's pretty wild herself. She's wild. She's a wild rich kid. She's fucking everybody all over the place. She and Lewis were an item. They went to Venice together in 1922 when I was born. They were celebrating my birth. But the thing is about Lewis, halfway through, even me, I said, I don't know, this is getting tedious. But I knew a lot. I knew so much else about him that I put up with it. But I think, Carolyn, you got a little pissed off halfway through, didn't you?
Not
tedious.
Well, it was tedious, but then we quickly said, well, there's just so many interesting events. It was like a day-by-day chronology.
Yeah, it's an incredible day-by-day. And because he's so interesting, we know what he does with it. When you know that, you can tolerate the tedium of him sabotaging everything.
Ooh, Nancy Kennard even dated black guys, which would have been super cool.
That was the 20s. That was the that's the rich people hanging out in Bohemia.
Yeah.
And Lewis would fuck all these women. They'd all fall in love with him, and he'd kick them out because he saw them all as phonies, as apes of God. They were just hanging out there because they could afford it. And he was serious. He was fucking trying to figure out what was going on and probe it. And he ends up to be the father of mediocology, which academia, Lance Straight, the Mediocology Association would never accept. But I slowly am telling people, showing people, that Wyndham Lewis was a major influence on Harold Innes and Marshall McLuhan. That's significant.
You know, I have that book. I never read it, Bob, Apes of God. Here it is right here. I'm getting it out right now.
Why do you have it? Did I tell you about it?
Yeah, you did. I was supposed to read it years ago, and I never did. Boy, it's a big old book. This would be hard to hold.
Yeah, and you won't be able to. You won't be able to read it. It's Finney's Wake in English. See, what he does, he writes a novel through the eye of a painter. So a painter is looking at all these weird visual clues or cues on weird angles that, you know, a normal person doesn't look at things. But imagine, you know, a guy's looking at somebody, he's doing a portrait, and he was a tremendous portrait painter, and he's looking at with his eyes the way you don't, we don't. He writes his novel describing things like that, so you don't know what the fuck he's describing. You know, it's very hard to read, but it's worth it in the long run.
So is it formal causality through words?
Well, what's formal causality? That's advertising studying the audience. Formal causality in making a private art object, like a book? Yes, you're looking at your audience's bias, and you want to mutate it. You want to correct it. So let's read the first paragraph. Let's see if it's a confusing.
Oh, you want me to? Oh,
right
okay.
Away. Yeah. Are you ready for this young lady, Kate, there?
I'm ready.
Kate.
Yeah, I'm ready.
The Nancy Kennard of Belgrade.
Yeah, Kate's prettier than Nancy Kennard.
Ready for more. Having a good time and ready for more.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So should I start at the prologue?
No, just the chapter one, the novel, where the novel starts.
Well, I think that is. It's death. It's Apes of God, prologue. Oh, dear Mabel. Is that where I start?
What's the next part? The sentence.
Okay, so
oh, dear
part
Mabel,
one,
who's saying that?
I don't know. I just opened the book. Or I can go to page, that's page 7, or I can go to page 27 is where the beginning is after the prologue. So part one, Dick.
All right, so let's read a bit of the prologue and see what that says.
Okay.
The first whatever.
All right. Oh, dear Mabel, a cat like a beetle goose stepped with eerie convulsions out of the night cast by a cluster of...
Okay, hold it. Can you visualize that? A cat like a beetle goose stepped... what?
Oh, my God.
With eerie convulsions out of the
eerie
night.
Eerie convulsions. Cat. Okay, how do you goose step with eerie convulsions? Yeah. Okay, it sounds like the novel part of it. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. A cat, like a beetle, and it's beetle, B-E-A-D-L-E. It's not beetle, a beetle. Mm-hmm. Goose-stepped with eerie convulsions out of the night cast by a cluster of statuary from the recesses of the entrance hall. A maid with matchless decorum left a door silently. She removed a massive copper candlestick. She reintegrated the gloom that the cat had left. The cat returned with the state
of its... She reintegrated the gloom that the cat had left. Oh, Jesus.
The cat returned with the state of a sacred dependent into the gloom. Discreet sounds continually rose from the nether stairhead, a dark whisper of infernal presences. The antlers of the hall suggested that full-busted stags were embedded in its substance. A mighty canvas contained it in its bronze shadows, an equestrian ghost who otherwise might have roughed the empty majesty of the house with confusing posthumous activity. Should a visitor from just within the entrance have been able to proceed at right angles to his left, overcoming...
What?
Left
at right angles to his left? What the fuck is that? Okay.
Overcoming septum after septum, hung as though with gigantic metals with the bulging gilt frames, he would have reached the gardener's tool shed and an arrangement of flagged steps, where the impeccable staff indulged in those trite exchanges inseparable from menial life with the more alert of the tradesmen's messengers. There was a gap where the rhododendron hedge was just exceeded by the stalwart street-front balustrade, where between the bulbous stone, the policeman could be observed at his usual occupation known as, "Oh, dear Mabel," which consists, and that's in a totally different font.
Yeah.
And this, yeah. So, anyway, should I read
well,
that's
on? That's good enough.
Yeah.
No, I don't even know what he's talking about.
I don't either.
you don't, Carolyn. Carolyn thinks. She's so intuitive. She uses ESP. That's all that Carolyn does.
No, you just put yourself in the scene and you can see it unfolding.
Okay, what is he describing?
He's describing a cat coming along as he's going into
the setting, the bigger environment. Describe that.
A house. And then you go up the steps and you turn left and you go to where the staff congregates and talks while they're waiting for the messengers.
That's
the
general
service
stuff. What about the reintegrating the gloom? What about the cop going, "Oh, Mabel," down the corner?
That's the scene.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, she's doing all
right.
Is
the whole book like that?
I'd like to see her read the whole fucking book, which, okay, Carol, why don't you read the whole fucking thing?
If it's on Kindle.
Yeah, if it's on Kindle, she'll read it. Because she wouldn't hold a big book like that. Now, she has read a Lewis book. She wrote Revenge for Love, about 1937. This Apes of God's 1930. And Revenge for Love is considered his most successful novel because he seems to have human sentiment in it. He seems to have a recognizable thing. But most people find Apes of God too abstract, too whatever. But it is awesome. And it's even about Aleister Crowley and that kind of stuff that's going on in England. It's an awesome book. I've read it in parts. I've never sat and read it all the way through. I've read it for 50 fucking years in parts and slow doses. And I knew what that was, but I'm just trying to get along with you guys and say, I don't have a fucking clue what he's describing. I'm just putting it on using formal causality. But formal causality, that's Aristotle's four causes. There's... What?
I was going to say, what's the difference between formal causality and efficient causality?
Efficient is how you make some popcorn. You know, you put the fucking popcorn in, you mix the other shit, and that's efficient production, practical
mm-hmm.
stuff. Formal causality
okay.
is what kind of sauce you're going to put on the popcorn to affect the audience who's going to eat it.
Ah, okay.
Depending on the effect you want of the popcorn. And then there's material causality. That's the matter of popcorn and coconut oil. And then final causality is where it ends up, what you make, like the practical goal for the stuff. So I guess
okay.
the final causality of popcorn is your stomach. So Aristotle, being under the influence of the alphabet, the phonetic alphabet, is starting to categorize this novelty of thinking in categories and breaking things down with visual space and writing it up and making an encyclopedia. That's the novelty of 400 B.C. in Athens. And that's what Aristotle's doing. Actually, he's more like 300-something. Aristotle's doing the new thing of thinking and writing it down and categorizing things. All right?
Okay.
So he divided causality into four parts, which nobody ever figured out after. What?
In the afterword of this book, I think Kate would like this last. This is the very last page of the whole book, and it says, "Oh, here's another picture of Wyndham Lewis when he was older." He's not as hot. He's hottie.
Yeah, where he's standing there with
the pipe,
a hat,
and
a coat,
yeah.
a pipe, and bad
yeah.
teeth. Yeah, that's 1938. The establishment has finally let him maybe enter into an exhibition of Vortis's paintings. I can't remember why. He's still out ostracized. He's going to run away from the country a year later after that photograph.
Mm-hmm.
And so he puts in his fantastic... First of all, what we're reading, the prose of Apes of God, T.S. Eliot, one of the men of 1914, one who made it, is acceptable because he joined the Anglican Church and all that. Lewis once said, talking about Eliot visiting him at his ghetto apartment, he says, T.S. Eliot doesn't come in here wearing Westminster Abbey. He hadn't come in here wearing Westminster Abbey. But anyways, Elliot put on Westminster Abbey, and he's a sociable, acceptable guy. And he says that Lewis was the first guy in a long time who created a new kind of English prose. He's saying that Lewis was incredibly innovative. And when the book came out, the Bloomsbury people, the Virginia Woolfs and the rest of them, just had a heart attack. Several died. They were shocked because Lewis satirized every one of them, nailed them with his amazing descriptive abilities, embarrassed everybody. So he was banned. And so he had nothing to do but go over to Germany to see what the Nazis were doing. That was in late 1930. So,
And that's interesting that you say, because this is what I was going to read. This is
okay.
The
let
afterwards.
Me finish another point.
Sure, I'm
so
sorry.
He is the inventor of prose, but most people think James Joyce invented stuff, and he did, but they don't know Lewis was greatly respected by T.S. Eliot for his writing style, his new kind of style. And he also, someone says, I don't know if it's Eliot, but other people of that level say that Lewis was the greatest portrait painter of British history. So, many people wouldn't agree with that for political reasons, but anyways, Lewis was a damn good portrait painter. And he made this incredible portrait of T.S. Eliot in 1938, and they put it in the exhibition, and the establishment of the museum, the Royal Museum, hated Lewis so much, they banned him and the portrait. So, he got a press pass from some newspaper, and he snuck into the exhibition, because he wasn't allowed in otherwise. They didn't trust him. And he writes a scathing review of the whole scene because he got in there. Well, that picture you're looking at is him standing in the courtyard with his fake press pass, sort of gloating there. You see how he's standing, like, triumphant?
Yep.
That's
yep.
what you got to know. And you don't know this stuff unless you read Sword of Genius. That book gives you the details of every little fucking thing that he did. It's incredible on that level. So I never knew when that photo was. No one ever gave me a date. But now with Paula Keith's book, we know exactly what he's gloating about. He's standing there with look at that, a fake press pass because he's so ostracized.
Wow.
They wouldn't even put it. His portrait of Eliot, years later in 1956, the year before he died, they had the next generation was there. They appreciated Lewis, the younger kids. Like Francis Bacon, them, they all love Lewis because they liked his rebellious stance. And they are celebrating him in 1956, and I think they got to see the portrait then. But it's considered one of the greatest portraits ever, and these idiots in 1938, for other reasons, political conspiracy reasons, wouldn't let anybody see it. That's what's so interesting about Lewis. He's the archetypal artist rebel, that one that everybody thinks artists are supposed to live up to. But he does it. Mm-hmm. He's a rebel against the fucking artist.
And he's still a good artist.
And he's still a fucking genius and most relevant guy and prepares us for the 21st century with his Media Ecology via McLuhan and Innes and his Quadriphenic Statement of How to Live Today. You're part fascist, part communist, part Marxist with a dollop of monarchism, and you're an anarchist with a healthy passion for order. Every one of you guys are that through your four bodies. And that makes me a genius because I'm the only one who can say all this fucking stuff. I don't know. Bert usually listens when we're talking. Bert emailed a couple hours ago. He's listening, I think. Who will not be here is Michael tonight. Yeah, go ahead. Someone's going to say something.
Did he do that portrait of Hitler?
I don't know. What portrait of Hitler? What do you mean?
The one that you displayed when you read from his book on Nazis.
He did do the drawings on the cover of his books. If it's a drawing, sketch or something, he would have done that.
No, this is a color. It's a color portrait.
I don't recall that. I've never seen him do. We've got an amazing collection of books with a lot of his art, and I've never seen a portrait by him of Hitler.
Okay. So when I googled Wyndham Lewis and hit images,
there's not many.
But the picture of you. You come up, Bob.
What? When you put Lewis and Hitler in?
When you just put in Lewis and hit pictures.
What do you mean? Bob Dobbs comes up?
Yeah, Bob Dobbs reading from Wyndham Lewis's book on Hitler.
Yeah, you're saying it comes out when you put in Wyndham Lewis Hitler.
When you put in Wyndham Lewis and hit images.
Just images, I come up.
Yes.
Wow. Because when I read, Hitler, when McLuhan met Lewis in 43, 44 and took him from Windsor, Ontario, Chad's birthplace, to, or where he grew up, I don't know if he was born in Windsor, and then McLuhan took him to St. Louis, Missouri, where McLuhan was a professor, to get portrait commissions for Lewis to get him out of his poverty. When he did that, McLuhan had a copy of Hitler, and it's in the middle of World War II, and he asked Wyndham Lewis to sign Marshall's copy of the scandalous book that's on the straight level. The bullshit middle-class world of reputation ruined Lewis's reputation, but that never stopped Lewis. It didn't matter that it ruined his reputation, but bourgeois college students say, oh, he was ruined by Hitler. So he gave it to Lewis to sign it, and Lewis ripped it up and threw it in the fireplace. He burned the fucking thing. So we don't know what Lewis really thought of it. Did he regret it or whatever? But he acted like that with McLuhan right there.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends on what Lewis was perceiving of McLuhan. Maybe he noticed a right-wing streak in McLuhan, which there was, and he says, stupid McLuhan is going to go down the right-wing path. I'll fucking stop that. So he threw the
mm-hmm.
book away. He ripped it up and threw it away.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, Lewis did all kinds of things. He told McLuhan, they were going to go to Windsor. And McLuhan had to get out of the United States because the draft was sneaking up on him. 1944, the war hasn't ended yet. And he's scheming to get out of the States and get back to Canada. So he's going to go and get a job at the university in Windsor. And Lewis would go back up there with him. And they would start a magazine. But just before McLuhan gets up there, or just before he gets up in Windsor to work with Lewis, Lewis leaves him a note and says, you are the worst person I've ever met. You have ripped me off. You've used our friendship, blah, blah. Totally evil, bad, paranoid note. And so Lewis wouldn't work with McLuhan. And then the war ended, and I don't know if he was homesick, but he said his wife was homesick, and they took off for London as soon as the war was over. As a matter of fact, this was an amazing parallel. This is where Lewis is an important person in history for these reasons. The day the war broke out, September 1st, 2nd, 3rd, when Hitler invaded Poland, 1939, Lewis was on a boat going across to New York City to escape from London, and that boat had to dodge and go up toward the cold Arctic regions to avoid Nazi submarines, all right? It was very risky. And the boat that they were meant to get on, he and his wife, they didn't get on because she wouldn't get on a boat on Friday 13th, so they went for another boat to sail on Saturday. The boat that they didn't get on sank, okay, 2 days later.
Wow.
It would have died.
Wow.
So Lewis always said, you know, his wife's superstition saved his life. Okay, so that's the week, the beginning of the war. Well, the week that the war ended, on August 6th and 9th, when the bombs were dropped on... Well, Hitler had ended in 1st of May, but the real ending of dropping the atomic bombs on Japan, first week of August 1939, very important end of history week. When did history end? When the bombs were dropped. Lewis was going back to London, crossing the Atlantic Ocean on a boat. The same time, at the beginning and the ending, is a major move in Lewis's life.
Hmm.
Neat. This is from the God's eye, bird's view of looking at humans interacting. You have the significant human. What is he doing on the week of the World War II starts? He's in the middle of the Atlantic. What's he doing the week the war ends? You know, 6 years later, he's in the middle of the Atlantic on a boat.
Oh.
So those are neat patterns.
Neat patterns.
Yeah, so what? Where were we going? So you were going to read the back, but I've explained
yeah.
the portrait at the back.
So this is the afterword of Apes of God. It says satire. So this is, I don't know who's writing this, but it's not Lewis. Well, maybe it is. It is. It is.
Yeah,
actually,
if it's an afterword, it looks like, I mean, what comes after the afterword?
Actually, it's not, because he's talking about Lewis and then quotes Lewis. It's an afterword by Paul Edwards.
Yeah, the guy I was telling you about, the major Lewis scholar, the establishment acceptable guy. Alan Mutton is the Wyndham Lewis of Lewis scholarship, and Paul Edwards is the T.S. Eliot of Lewis scholarship.
Okay. Satire.
So this image shows up of me, Hitler. Okay. When I got a copy of Hitler a few years ago and wanted to read it to our payday audience, I told Alan Mutton I was going to do this. He kind of begged me not to do it.
I remember something about that.
Yeah, he leans toward respectability a little bit, like, hey, we're just trying to get Lewis back on the map, and any talk of that book causes problems.
So what is Bob doing?
No, wait a minute. Yeah, wait for it. So he told me that the fact that Lewis was involved with the fascists is not a problem for young kids. The quadriphenic millennials, they have no problem. They have friends who go Nazi or celebrate, Charles Manson. They're all crazy, extreme, right? See, that's why David Bowie, who's a big fan of Wyndham Lewis, says that Lewis was the first cyberpunk. That's how avant-garde he was. Eliot wasn't a cyberpunk. Joyce wasn't. Lewis was. And when I spoke to Lewis through the Evergreens, James Joyce presented himself as a Luddite who wouldn't take any modern technology, only interested in writing and books. Lewis said, give me that word processor, man. I can do so much with that. He's totally into the new, Wyndham Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
So Alan Mutton said, even though the kids are more tolerant, still, I'd rather you not do that. I said, okay, that's no problem. I don't know what I said. That was ambiguous. So, of course, I go and do it. I read the book. And I didn't intend it, but now you put Wyndham Lewis, and do you put Hitler or just put Wyndham Lewis in?
Just Wyndham Lewis. I was looking for.
And I come up. I'm now the top hit.
Yep.
Oh yeah. Well, image is the category. See, just write in Wyndham Lewis. My bad screwing up of the Wyndham Lewis project to rehabilitate him is sabotaged, and Alan Mutton warned me. Don't do it, Bob, and he was right. My thing shows up. That's incredible.
Yeah?
To me, not to you guys. You guys have your own lives to live. You don't want to hear anything about Lewis. You're barely
tolerating. No, I thought it was remarkable. That's why I specifically asked, because it's not his painting. I thought it was, if it was his painting, it would have made sense. But
right,
it's not.
But it's an audio. It's almost like the Android meme wants to continue to sabotage Lewis.
Correct.
So they hoik up my fucking stuff to ruin Lewis.
Well, or call attention to him in the way that he needed to be remembered, which is the way that you would describe.
Yeah.
That would be more the way I would see it.
Good. Okay, I'll use you in my defense against Alan Mutton and Paul Edwards
when they him call me. I'll tell him.
Okay, is Kate there, or did she fall off and I've got to unmute her? Hey there, Kate. Probably have to unmute her. Yeah, there's a lot of people here. That's you, Kate, right?
That's me.
Yeah. So we missed your laughter during the last 15
minutes.
Yeah,
you did.
Okay, well, it would have been irritating because it's a serious topic. Your silly laughter would have been...
Well, this quote is about laughter, so this is for Kate. This is why I want to read it.
Yes,
right. You might have missed what I said. Her laughter would have been rather Lewisian. I want you guys to note that I said that. You drowned out with your chatter. Lewisian. Lewisian. You know what
mm-hmm.
I mean? Like Wyndham Lewis.
Yeah. Yep.
And it would have been annoying, Kate. Your child.
Exactly.
Game. Yeah.
I disagree with
you know
about the laughter.
You've learned the hard way. Or the easy
I
want to
know the laughter.
But you're free to laugh now. Now that we're outside of that serious topic. So,
I want to hear what Katie's going to read.
Yeah, she's going to
her laughter would have reintegrated the gloom.
Yes, we didn't want that. We had to talk about the seriousness of what I was doing.
Yes.
Okay, so satire, as complete and unsparing as Lewis's, ultimately takes us beyond questions of the psychology, biography, and politics of its author. It opens us to a tragic view of life. And then this is Lewis being quoted here. As a matter of fact, no man, any more than the shell-shocked man, should be laughed at. It is unfair. Therefore, it is caddish to laugh at anybody. We all, as much as the shell-shocked man, really could cry cad at an outburst of mirth at our expense. And this does not only apply to the obviously defective. It is unnecessary to enumerate the tragic handicaps that our human conditions involve, the glaring mechanical imperfections, the nervous tics, the prodigality of objectness movement. It is only a matter of degree between us and the victim of locomotor taxi or St. Vitus dance. And then the guy, what's his name, Paul, goes on and says, but Lewis implies if we can laugh at our tragic condition, we will find it more bearable. And we can add for him that sometimes to revel in our imperfections, as Lewis allows us to do in The Apes of God, can be as cathartic as tragedy itself. The laughter that this great satire provokes is the kind Lewis described in the catalog of the attributes of laughter included in the 1917 essay, Inferior Religions. And so Lewis has these categories of laughter. Oh, gosh, Suri was talking to me. Sorry. He's got these four categories of laughter. Laughter is an independent, tremendously important, and lurid emotion. Laughter is the representative of tragedy when tragedy is away. Laughter is the emotion of tragic delight. Laughter is the female of tragedy. And that's where the book ends.
Yeah, it's awesome. You know, back in the 60s, I read, I guess it was McLuhan's essay on Wyndham Lewis. I hadn't read any Lewis. I didn't know much about him, though I had met him as a kid, but I didn't know who I was meeting, though I had a psychic flash, but that's, you can read that in my diaries. Anyways, in the essay, McLuhan points out the two kinds of laughter that there were, and Bergson represented one kind of humor, and Lewis celebrated another kind. And I don't know if both kinds were enumerated by Lewis, but McLuhan said it. That was the first time I started thinking about something. In my mind, that was like, what? There's different kinds of laughter? You know, it's so much part of your life or my life, laughter, that you don't think about it. It's an invisible environment. So Lewis was the first, his thought that Paul is touching on here, the several kinds of laughter, that was the first time I thought about something in a, what do you call it, self-reflexive, meta-level, or a deep philosophical way, or a startling way, was that. And I was known for laughing a lot, so it probably hit me in one of what Gurdjieff calls your chief feature. My chief feature is my laughter aspect. So I was made to think about it by Lewis.
Very cool.
Yeah, so that and there he is. They're talking about the four types of laughter. Mm-hmm. Have you ever thought of laughter in that way? Probably not.
No. Nope.
It's one of the most human things, so it's our chief invisible environment of our humanness, and we don't think about it. But Lewis did. Let me tell you what I learned. So Bergson had normal, we call it the pink sense of humor, when someone slipped on a banana peel. That's sort of like slapstick stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That was what Lewis called mechanical humor. Wasn't as good as this other kind of humor. And the other kind of humor is, Lewis says, a human being is not a human, it's a thing. And when a thing tries to be human, that's great laughter evoking. So when a human turned into a machine by slipping into a banana strip, banana peel, that's the human becoming machine. That evokes laughter. But if you're more subtle and more sensitive and know the absurdity of life, and you know humans are ridiculous, then you begin with the human as a thing, and what's funny is when they try to be human. And you'll see that in Lewis's novels. It's all about people trying to change the world or do something dramatic and good, and it ends up in tragedy. So that's a thing trying to be human.
So
I like that.
He probably didn't see his own life as tragic, where other people were calling him a loser and seeing it as tragic, he might have actually thought it was hilarious.
That's right, he did. Like, the way the guy could carry on is incredible, despite all this adversity. And he goes blind, 1950 or so, and he still writes 5 more books while blind.
Sounds like Joyce.
Yes, in a way. But I don't know if Joyce was totally blind. He wasn't totally blind.
Well,
Lewis was standing.
Really? How did he go blind? Did he have syphilis?
Yeah, Joyce still corrected his proofs of his books. You know, he still could do it. He had a problem, a thing in his brain or something. There's a lot of... What? A brain tumor, right. And he was misdiagnosed and that. But he had a contraption, a table, that he would write in big letters, like 5 lines a page, and then it would fall off the table platform he was using, and his wife would pick it up and put it in order. And that's what he did. He wrote in big scrawl on a piece of paper, so he used up endless paper to write these things because, you know, he'd write in big style. And he would have a thing that measure his pen could go down. They describe it in detail in the book. Some sort of genius. I can't visualize it. I don't know what it is. I can't visualize things. See, I'm primed for the tactile era, for the ionic era, because I don't have any visual bias. I sold it. Why don't you have any visual bias? Well, I wasn't using it, so I sold it to the devil.
Okay, so listen, we've been talking for 3 hours and 15 minutes, and we got through 1, chapter 4, and we had prepared through chapter 12. We read part 2, so we read chapters 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. Many of them are quite short, but it's been 3 hours and 15 minutes, and I think we should stop and pick this up. We can just go slower.
Okay.
And let some other people talk, because 3 hours and 15 minutes is enough of KDK.
Yeah, so chapter 4 was that Communication Makers article, right? His lecture.
Correct. And then next we have...
Yeah, and that's a very important article. It requires a long dissertation, which we did.
Okay. Which
really
is really
important.
Interesting, because I thought that was the least of the... And I mean, I thought the others were more important, so I was... wrong.
Well, to understand the background to McLuhan, it's really important, but, you know, the other ones have all McLuhan in them, not Lewis, so they're important.
Right. And then we'll, so next week we'll start with his first conversation with Father Babin, Pierre Babin.
Great. Now, you assigned chapters 4 to 12?
Yeah, because I thought we could do part 1 of the book, part 2 of the book, and part 3 of the book, and that would just take 3 shows over 6 weeks,
right,
and not, you know, hog up the time.
Yeah.
But we'll just start again, and if we decide we don't want to do it in 2 weeks and you want to push it to another week, we've got all this prepared now. We have 5 through 12 Kate and I read for this week.
Yeah, now so. I might read these parts again.
Yeah, read them again, knowing more. And,
yeah.
And we're in part 2?
Correct.
Yeah.
Which is, which chapters is part 2?
It's chapters 4 through 12. So part 1 is all about Marshall's conversion. We talked about that. We know he's a Catholic. We're cool with that.
We know he's not a Catholic, and we're cool with that.
We're cool with whatever, but you know. So
4 to 12, and then there's chapters in part 3. 13
Correct.
To 20 or something. Wow.
Correct. So we've got his conversation with Pierre Babin in chapter 5. Then we've got the de-Romanization of the American Catholic Church, chapter 6. Our Only Hope is Apocalypse, chapter 7. The Logos Reaching Across Barriers, which the letters to Ong, Mole, Maritain, and Culkin.
Yeah.
All fathers. And then 9, the International Motley in Religious Costume. And then 10, Electric Consciousness in the Church, and that's his conversation with Hubert Hoskins, that BBC reporter from The Listener.
Yeah.
And then 11, A Peculiar War to Fight, his letter to Robert J. Luver, who's the U.S. Bureau of Engraving and Printing.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? And then 12, Religion and Youth, which is his second conversation with Pierre Babin. And then we get into part three, which is Vatican II, Liturgy and the Media. But that could be weeks at the rate we're going.
Right. And this, what's number five or six?
Five is his first with Pierre Babin.
Yeah, six, De-Romanization.
Yep, six is the De-Romanization.
Have you got the book there? Are you looking at the book?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, go to the last paragraph. Of de-Romanization.
Sure. This is a short little chapter, last paragraph.
Let's see if what I think is...
Being wide awake is a frightening nightmare. Being wide awake is a frightening...
Yeah, whatever the last paragraph is.
I am reading it. Being wide awake is frightening, a nightmare. The problem of orientation means that dropouts will only be at the top. The dropouts will be the cardinal ledgers, who left his diocese to work among the lepers. The higher up in the hierarchy, the harder it is to get involved. We must get rid of the hierarchy if we want participation, but we won't have to wish for it. It's happening. We are on the verge of the apocalypse. In fact, we are living in it.
Okay, so the paragraph before that, look for Methuselah. You know, capital lettered word. I'm pretty sure it's near the end of the essay. I thought it was in the last paragraph. Can you see the word Methuselah?
Oh, yeah. Enoch and
read it, Kate.
Methuselah.
And what paragraph? Is this on the last page, Kate?
It is, but it's the second paragraph.
Yeah. Second, not the last. Not second last. It's the second of four.
Oh, like the middle. Right.
The middle of the book. Okay.
You want me to...
Yeah, read it.
Okay. Until electricity, technology fragmented... The whole of genius is concerned with the attempt of man to build new technologies. When Cain, a tiller of the ground, wanted to become more than a simple farmer, he slew Abel, the keeper of sheep. When men began to build cities or towers, a technology of bricks, as in Babel, fragmented mankind. When man worshipped pagan idols, it meant the worshipping of tools. Enoch and Methuselah were not so much persons as long-lived cultures, tribal kinship groups, or totalities, all of them fallen and fragmented. Man lost human respect, living as somnambulists, hypnotized by their own technologies.
Right. So I read that when that came out in 1970 or so. I went into St. Michael's College. They always had the Catholic books. I'd always get the latest McLuhan books in their library, which is right beside McLuhan's coach house, and so I could keep up on the Catholic part of McLuhan. So he's saying Methuselah, these people are supposed to live, you know, thousands of years or whatever. They weren't people. They were tribal groups or countries or some kind of mass phenomenon, right?
Mm-hmm.
They were not individuals. So at the time, I thought, oh, that's pretty interesting. These guys didn't live 800 years. They were just the history of that tribe. Well, we learned from Ion the exact opposite. Enoch is not a tribe. Enoch is an amazing person who I think is still alive. Methuselah is still alive. They're individuals. And that's the difference between Ion's Catholicism and McLuhan's Catholicism. McLuhan's is conventional and, quote, wrong, and Ion's tells you new knowledge. Okay?
Yeah.
So, that's for later, the difference between Ion and McLuhan. I mean, McLuhan does a pretty good job anticipating some aspects of Ion. But a statement like that is, Ion would tear it up and throw it in the fire.
Hmm.
Right? Because mm-hmm. it's...
What if the word somnambulist... Hypnotized by their own technology.
That means walking in your sleep.
Oh, okay.
Somnambulist.
Asleep.
McLuhan used to say that people were motivated somnambulists. So walking around asleep, but actually having a purpose, motivated, even though they're asleep. And that's playing off Finnegan's Wake. Finnegan's Awake. Or Finnegan's Funeral, Finnegan's Wake. Yeah, the idea that humans live forever, that's not in McLuhan's public consciousness anyways. Because he says...
Do you think we're living in the apocalypse now?
Oh, yeah. Ayn says we are. The Armageddon, the apocalypse, that's what's happening. But apocalypse means, technically, most people think it means Armageddon, some big, you know, horrible war. No, apocalypse is when there are no secrets. And we do live in a media-saturated revelation of every secret possible in our social and political and personal unconscious. That's been going on through most of the 20th century under electric transparency. So we've been in apocalyptic times. McLuhan is saying that in 1970.
Because you're saying before that, like when you're at the beach and you see people hiding in their phones, that they're hiding from the apocalypse, but they don't realize they're actually in the apocalypse.
Well, I say back in 1990 with that album and the song, everything disappeared. The digital phones attempt to reappear, panickingly trying to text and contact a fellow human being. The disappearance, the apocalypse in many ways long happened. I'm an advocate of overcoming the apocalypse through Iondom. We're in the middle of it. We have a solution. Everybody has been disappeared. And I said in 1995, Carol and I were the first to reappear with the D-cell, which was a, you know, a lowbrow interpretation of Iondom and the I-cell. Right, Katie? If you're still here.
I'm here. I just put myself on mute to make a cup of tea.
Right. So you're going to, you know, we're going to talk about different things. So you can go if you have to go on for bedtime purposes.
Yeah, I probably will because it's actually, we spring forward. So it's like 1 o'clock in the morning, but really it's 2.